This is Scripture Read Badly,
a podcast where two grown-up pastors' kids discuss the stories of the Bible in chronological order,
attempting to avoid heresy and generally having a good time.
I'm Jeremy.
And I'm Ryan.
Sit back and rejoice. Today's verse comes from Numbers 1, verses 54. Thus did the people of Israel, they did according to all that the Lord commanded Moses. This is a great example of how the Bible lies. Because the people of Israel didn't do all that the Lord commanded Moses. That's why they got kicked off the land later. Unbelievable Numbers. Boo! This is Scripture Read Badly. I'm Jeremy, and this week we're starting into Numbers, or if the Jewish title is taken, it's called In the Wilderness, apparently.
And I'm Ryan.
What?
Yeah, welcome back, everyone. Even though we didn't take a break between Leviticus and Numbers, welcome to a new book of the Bible. And you're right, Jeremy, the Hebrew for the title of this book is In the Wilderness, which is probably a great name for it because it all happens in the wilderness. However, there are so many numbers in this book that I just can't go past the English name.
Numbers of what?
Numbers of everything. Numbers of people, numbers of lampstands, numbers of trumpets, numbers of Moses interceding for the people, numbers of people dying, numbers of people rebelling, numbers
and just numbers of people.
Yeah, and numbers of talking donkeys and stuff. So there's a lot of great things ahead in this book, though I'm not sure how many episodes we'll actually cover in it, because it's only
probably 17.
Yeah, all right. I mean, there's what, mid-20s of chapters in this book? So
there's definitely mid-20s.
Is that how... That's not how you speak. I was just getting all confused with numbers. I was getting my numbers mixed up.
No, it's mid-30s.
It is. 36. So 17 episodes in this book? Yeah, I reckon we can do it. So
I think it'll be 4, maybe 5 at a punch.
Yeah, well...
At a punch?
I don't know if that's all an right. expression.
I don't think that's an expression.
Oh, that's awesome. Great. So, Numbers is the fourth book of the Bible, the fourth book of the Torah, the Pentateuch, the Law, the books of Moses, the books
the
of
Bumblebee
the Law,
Tuners.
The Bumblebee Tuners. The fourth book. That's a number. And I think as we're going through this book, we'll point out all these numbers as they happen. And we'll try and count them. Because that's
like
you
the
do
count
with
from Sesame Street.
Exactly.
Yes.
Great. So maybe we'll do that each time there a number is spoken. Okay. So we are going to give a little bit of context and a bit of an overview in this episode. We may go into some of the first part of Numbers, but to begin with, let's talk about a bit of what's happened up to this point. Jeremy?
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then they created people.
Yep.
And the people misunderstood / completely rebelled against the idea of life begetting life, and started painting themselves with death, and then drinking death, and just performing death everywhere. And so God then had to pull out a remnant of the people to save, and then had to scatter everybody around to save us. And then those people made some interesting financial and economic decisions and were oppressed by the Egyptians for a while.
Yep.
And then God pulled out another remnant to take through the wilderness to train, because he had promised them a land of milk and honey. And because of some interesting social decisions, God decided to walk them through the wilderness for a while to train a generation of young people to love him, and to wait till the older generation that did not love him to die. which is a little harsh, but
yay,
that's where we find them in the wilderness, so getting trained or died.
This book of the Bible begins at the tail end of Israel's stay at Mount Sinai. And as I'm sure you remember from Leviticus, there is a point where God says, all right, that's it. Pack up your stuff. You're heading to the wilderness. Now, at this point, Jeremy, refresh my memory. Had God already said, you generation will not enter the promised land, or was that a consequence for a rebellion that happens in Numbers?
Ooh, that's a very good question, Ryan. And at this stage, I don't remember. I feel like it should have already happened in Exodus.
Or Leviticus. I just don't remember. I agree.
No, I don't think it happened in Leviticus. You can Google it, or should I?
I will. Yeah, you can Google that. So, the Book of Numbers is interesting because it has a census that is taken at the beginning of this book, and there is a census at the end of this book, or there's maybe one in the middle as well. But the point being, the beginning, the first census is all about numbering the fighting men of the generation that left Egypt. And then the last census is numbering the generation of people entering the promised land. That is the children of the original generation. So it's pretty interesting to see how they get from point A to point B, and how an 11-day journey ends up taking 40 years. There's a couple of numbers in there, so I'll just myself.
How many?
Oh, there was an 11 and there was a 40. So, yep. So this is at the end of the 1 year stay at Mount Sinai. So we are now 39 years until they enter the promised land. Which is pretty interesting that that entire span of time is covered in this book of Numbers. I don't think up to this point we've seen... I think in Exodus there was a significant jump of time a couple of times, from the birth of Moses to Moses being 40 years old and killing a guy and then disappearing and then coming back 40 years later. So there's been some and
killing
times
another guy.
And killing
on,
another
man.
Guy.
When not allowed to kill.
There's been these... no, you can kill, but you can't murder. Oh, when true. There has been these jumps forward in time. And so here we will have a more gradual one, I think, than we have seen in the past. I mean, if you're thinking back to Genesis, there's jumps forward in time all the dang time. And I think that is because it's supposed to cover such a large period. So here we have a book that takes place in 39 years. It's in a few different sections, according to the Bible Project, which are an amazing couple of guys that have awesome videos on YouTube. It's in five different sections, and so it covers them at Mount Sinai, and then them in the wilderness, then them in the wilderness of Paran, and then them in the wilderness again, and then them in Moab. And so there's these stages of the journey, and if you look at a map throughout this, which is very difficult to describe because this is an audio medium, if you look at a map throughout this whole journey, you see that they kind of go up, down, loop-de-loop, all these...
It looks like a cat.
It's basically like...
A cat head.
Like a cat put a pencil in its mouth and drew a cat on a piece of paper.
That's a good visual description.
Yeah, thank you. Well, that is what this medium is all about. So... Jeremy, what do you have to say about the Book of Numbers before we really launch into some specifics?
A little bit, like I said before, it is a travel book of sorts that God gives the people an opportunity to take the promised land, and they decided not to because of fear, and so God then had to retrain them to fear him instead of the big people, mainly through two of the spies that came back with good reports, who then end up being the leaders of the free world at that time,
yep.
Joshua and Caleb. Although I don't think Caleb does much leadership. It's mainly Joshua.
Yeah.
And throughout this, it shows God's want of them arranging their camp a certain way, reminding them of all of the principles he gave them at the start in Exodus. And Deuteronomy is at the end of this big jaunt through the wilderness. And so he reminds them again. So it's like a microcosm of what happens throughout the rest of the Old Testament. He gives them the law, and then he describes what happens with the law. And so Numbers is like a small, like a one-shot adventure of the Israelites, one generation after he gives them all of these principles. And most of the time they fail. And most of the time they're like, nah. But there are times when they take the principles on board and do some cool stuff, which we'll see.
The author of Numbers is traditionally credited to Moses. And yeah. there are times where the first person voice is actually used, and they say, we went to this place and we did this. But then there's also these other parts where it talks about Moses in the third person tense. And unlike the apostle, not the apostle, unlike the Dr. Luke in the New Testament, who in the book of Acts, when he is recounting his journey with the apostle Paul, he actually says, we went to this place and I was with Paul, blah, blah, blah. This is more like we as the collective people of Israel went to this place, and the man Moses was very meek, and he did this, blah, blah, blah. And so,
classic meekness.
Yeah, there's a little bit of discrepancy there, but I don't really think it matters. And this goes back to what we were talking about in the Genesis season. We were talking about the authorship of the Pentateuch in general.
Yeah.
And I think we decided that whether Moses wrote it or whether it was somebody writing it down as Moses was dictating, or if it was oral traditions that were passed down and then written down, anything yeah. like that is a, it's a very acceptable, and I don't, it's a very acceptable view of the authorship, and I don't think it necessarily matters very much.
Me neither.
I think the point is, these stories are available to us now, and we can read them, we can discuss them, and we can learn from them. And I think that was the whole point of the Pentateuch in the first place. Am I wrong?
No.
Great. That's probably the first time.
No.
Come on.
Agree to disagree.
All right.
But I think...
So I'm wrong now.
Currently, yes.
Yes, alright.
Ooh, there was something in the background.
Yeah, there's a motorbike.
Ooh, hello. Motorbikes are the worst. Oh. Unless you're riding them. Or unless they're silent somehow. I was listening to a podcast the other day too, and they were like, yeah, and some people believe that the book of Deuteronomy was like written in hindsight and stuff was added. And I'm like, well, all of it was oral, or at least most of it was oral.
Mm.
And they lost the book of Deuteronomy for ages until I think it was King Josiah found it again. And who knows what kind of state it was. It definitely wasn't perfectly bound in Times New Roman script. And so maybe it was added to.
Papyrus font?
But even... Oh, pirate's font would be nice.
I said papyrus, but papyrus is cool too.
Pirates font is what they would have had. Because they're the king of the seas.
Mm.
And so I just don't really care, because the more I read these books, the more they just fit together, and they fit together in a big arrow to Jesus, and Jesus logically in my brain just makes the most sense of any worldview.
Awesome.
So I just don't care.
Great. Well, neither do I. And I think that's because I spent so long...
That's why we're friends, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I spent so long thinking it mattered.
Yeah.
And I think what I've come to realize, especially since starting this podcast, but in the last couple of years, it's been... I have gone from the position of wanting to die on the hill of authorship and all that type of thing to now, yep, I don't really mind whether I got this passed down to me orally or if I got passed down to me written or whatever. I think the point is it's available.
Yeah.
And the point is that it is applicable and that it points to Jesus and that Jesus taught from it and Jesus fulfilled it.
Yeah, exactly. And
I think that's the most important thing. Not necessarily if Moses was the one that wrote the whole Pentateuch except the last chapter, which talked about the death of Moses, unless he had some kind of vision. There was a flash forward to what was going to happen in about 10 minutes when he went up the mountain.
I got it.
Yeah. Or maybe... Yeah, maybe he went up there with some parchment and a quill of some kind, and he was writing it down, and he went, all right, that's good, that's my final journal entry, and then he passed it to Joshua, and he said, all right, go take him in. Yep. See ya. See ya never.
See ya, champ.
Okay, so we've said that this book of the Bible is a censorship. That is not a censorship, a census that has been taken, the censorship of the people of Israel. And so it actually begins with listing all these fighting men, everybody. And I think it is so that God himself can prove to the Israelites that they should be blown away by the amount of people that have survived in the wilderness up to this point.
Oh, okay.
That have exited, maybe? And then... Exited Egypt. And then when they get to the end of the book, it is a further testament of how many people there still are 39 and a half years later. Maybe. One view.
But then don't a lot of people die during that time?
Heaps of people die, but the fact that they had a...
heaps of babies.
They had heaps of babies. So many babies. And in some cases, multiple wives still, because I don't necessarily think that was outlawed in what we've read so far. Okay, so as far as the actual numbers in this book of Numbers... go, there have been many, many scholarly disagreements.
Ooh, scholarly.
Scholarly. Scholarly.
Scholarly.
And so the problem comes in that with the first census that is taken, the number of fighting men that is written down or recorded is... around 603,550. That's a lot of numbers. That's a lot of numbers. And so that's the summary of all the fighting men from all these different tribes and family groups and everything. When you add them all up, it's 603,550. And that's in Numbers 146. And then in Numbers 26:51... it is roughly 39, 40 years after the first census. It says that there are 603... hang on.
Billion.
No. In fact, it looks like it's the same number. So whether my ESV Study Bible's summary of the book is wrong or what, my guess is most likely... I think the point of this is that there's roughly the same amount of people, same amount of fighting men listed at the end of the book of Numbers as there is at the beginning. And so people have said that over 600,000 fighting men implies that there were roughly 2 million people in the children of Israel. And that's what we've been saying for the last little while, right?
Yep.
Cool. So 2 million people leave a country... leave it decimated and having to start from the ground up. They all go out into the Arabian Peninsula and they are wandering around the desert for a very, very, very long time. A journey that should be quite short becomes a lifetime.
Yes.
So
a huge camp out.
Yeah. I mean, it is the biggest staff retreat that you have ever seen.
Yeah. It's the camp out of all camp outs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It is the campiest of camp outs.
It's the Beyonce of all camp outs.
Yeah. That's right. So the different objections that have come into play throughout the years, people saying that 40 years in the wilderness, it seems too difficult to imagine how more than 2 million people survive for 40 years in the wilderness. And so that's if you take a literal approach to this and you take the numbers at face value, the book of numbers at face value, then you see 2 million people survive in the wilderness for 40 years. Well, I mean, people die and people are born, but there's roughly around the same amount of people at the end. And that is a huge achievement. And it is a testament to the provision and the miraculous protection of God.
Yeah.
Yet, another view suggests that the archaeological evidence for the overall population of the Promised Land was apparently, just after the Exodus, was below 3 million people. And that's relating to a couple of the other texts from the Pentateuch. And apparently there would not have been enough Israelites to take possession of the Promised Land all at once. Now, yep. The objection to that, obviously, is that God can do anything, and he could very easily overpower 3 million people with 600,000, because he can do anything.
Because he's God? So,
because he God. And then the third problem suggested is that some of the numbers may reflect mathematical oddities, because a lot of the figures are rounded to an even 100, which I think makes sense that that they would do that if there were so many numbers. If the book was named places, then, well, they wouldn't necessarily need that many listed. But the fact that it's called numbers, they're thinking there's going to be a lot of people numbered. Let's just round things up, make it nice and clean. Okay. So then, like I said, there were some solutions to those proposed problems. But whether you think the numbers are symbolic, whether there was some kind of scribal misunderstanding throughout the ages that meant that the word for thousand was translated, or the word for group or clan was translated as a thousand, and there was really only supposed to be, whatever, 72,000 people instead of 600,000, I don't know if it necessarily matters. The point is, God protected them. It doesn't say that their numbers plummeted. Otherwise, that's what the book would be called, Numbers Plummet.
That'd be a completely different book.
Yeah. Yes, that sounds like some kind of handbook or commentary on stock exchange or something.
Or some weird genocide.
Yes. Wow. Yep. Well, what we see is that God protects and provides, and they take possession of most of the land.
And mostly, does what he said he would do.
Yes. Yes, that's right. So I think the point of all of this is that there is an instruction that God gives, and he sees that it is fulfilled. Am I wrong there?
Yes.
Okay. Please, tell me how I am wrong, or why I'm
wrong. Nope, you're not wrong.
Okay, great. I am not wrong. So, what do you have to say about potential reasons that God would ask the people of Israel to number all their fighting men?
This is weird for me because then later when David does it, it's a sin.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so And I don't know if that's connected to God's hope that kings would trust in him for their power and not their own fighting man's strength.
Mm.
But then, because they don't have a king yet at this stage, are they counting the men because God wanted to give them some kind of faith in their own strength? Or was it because they wanted to be tracking the generation that was going to be lost? But then at this point, he hadn't said that the generation would be lost.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's the start of this is your nation and this is how big they are, because they wouldn't have known how big they were in Egypt.
Right. Okay. So it's kind of establishing them as a nation separate from... yeah. So maybe it's kind of imparting a sense of identity and ownership to their situation.
Yeah.
Whereas before have just seen themselves as a displaced people, now God is saying, no, you're a nation, and this is how many fighting men you have, and that seems to be some kind of that seems to be important to the nations around. That's how they measure their might and their size. So God is saying, you are among these other nations, you have a strong army, or you have the ability to be one. And he's kind of establishing them amongst the nations that they see around them, maybe?
Yep. Or maybe it's also like the book of Leviticus was, these are what the Leviticus people do, like the priests and that. These are who they are, and this is what they do. And then this builds on that by saying that the listed people in the camp of Dan were 157,600.
Yep.
And they needed to do this and this and this. And so let's say you had married someone from outside your tribe and you weren't necessarily sure where the lines were drawn, and then you didn't know what your role was in this whole thing. So God's saying, like, the census, we're counting you as a Danite and not whoever you married into, and your role is to do this. So when they pick up the tabernacle, there's a certain clan that picks up the tent, there's a certain clan that picks up the poles, there's a certain clan that picks up all of this. And they wouldn't know that if they didn't know what they were a part of and how many people were responsible of that. So I wonder if this is the start of God organizing them as a force, both militarily but also roles and such.
Responsibility-wise.
Yeah.
Yay, organization. That is... Yeah, that's great.
Like a team.
I like that. Yeah. That's right. It's kind of like the pre-game chat where the coach sits you down and says, this is how things are going to go. This is your position. This is what you're responsible for. And as a whole unit, this is what we are going to achieve.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
which
like
is
that.
Then reflected in the New Testament when God's like, you're all different and you all have different strengths and you all come together as a whole, instead of this guy can do it all, and so we're going to put all of the responsibility on that guy. I think God is returning to that idea in Exodus 18 of, I want the authority in the lowest hands I can, so that it's spread instead of in a king's hand, so it's concentrated.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I like that. So what's interesting about chapter 1 of Numbers, and we've just kind of been talking about the entire book in general, but... So most of chapter 1 is taken up with the lists of all these different names, all these different tribes, lots of head by heads said in the ESV.
Head by heads.
Plenty of multiples of 5 and 10. It's interesting that, that's for all the numbers people out there, the Levites are not listed among the fighting men. So when God instated them as the priesthood, as the tribe that was to dedicate their livelihoods to the service of God and the spiritual maintenance of the entire people, he had them exempt from being fighting men. Now, the reason I say that's interesting is because when the golden calf fiasco happened, Moses said, who is with me? What is going to happen? is there anyone here that will execute the judgment of God? And all the Levites came to him and said, yeah, we're with you. And they all drew their swords and killed everyone. So they've already proven that they are, I guess, in a way, fighting men. But then that was in response to the call that God placed through Moses, I suppose. But then God said, great, you did that. Good on you. You have that as life experience. That was your work experience. You can hand in your form next Thursday. And then he says, now, this is your job. Even though you have that experience, you know how to handle a sword, that's great. You're going to be going up against a lot of people. But they aren't listed in the census. What is, from your understanding, what is the reason for that?
Because the Levites were the 10%, right?
Yep. Like relatively,
when God took the tithe of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're his. They're not the people's people. They're God's people. And so if they were counted in the people, it would be like the people are taking them back. But they've been given to God.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't... And then they're given small pieces of land in everyone's land when they get to the promised land.
Yay.
Because they're separate to what God had for the rest of the people.
Mm-hmm.
But I also wonder, and you may have said it just then in a different way, when it comes to fighting, they weren't supposed to be in a part of it because they were responsible for something that the others couldn't do. So if they had been killed, they wouldn't have a way to get to the system to get back with God.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if that was a part of it too, that God was like, nope, they're out of it because I need them for this other thing.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, at the end of the first chapter here of Numbers, God does give them a job, and it is to take care of the tabernacle and all its furnishings and everything. And when they move to a new place, they're going to pitch the tent and build everything from scratch. But I like that. I like that the people that are responsible for the spiritual upkeep of the nation are the ones that are protected by not being the ones that go to war.
Yep.
I like that a lot. And then in chapter 2, God gives instructions into how to arrange the camp of Israel. And it is with four different nations in... Am I wrong? Three different nations in four directions around the Tent of Meeting. So the Tent of Meeting is smack dab in the middle of the camp. And then there are three tribes on each of its sides protecting it. And so then the symbolism here, it has been suggested, is that it is saying God and the relationship with Yahweh should be at the center of the nation.
Yep.
So it's not only a protective stance, because obviously the tabernacle was important to God, but it's also a symbolic stance that the nation of Israel takes each time they set up camp. It is to remember that the heart and soul of the nation is that tent of meeting.
So, it's Jesus!
It's Jesus. What's your take on that?
On Jesus?
On the arrangement.
On the arrangement, I think it's in the shape of a cross, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm.
Which is Jesus.
Yeah.
And it also meant that people had a place to belong each time. So yes, they were a traveling refugee camp, sort of. But God was instating, like, this is where you belong in the camp. This is the part that you own. Which is then also given to them with the land. Everyone gets their own land. And bloody bloody. So I really like it. And I really like that they have an order to when they leave.
Yep.
And that they're all close in to the tabernacle. And it also gives them boundaries to their living spaces. So when they have to leave the camp, when they're dirty or whatever, they know exactly where to go. Like there's as little confusion as possible, which God continues throughout the ages. He doesn't want us to be in confusion. He wants us to know him and know his principles. So the systems that he sets up are quite obvious.
Yes.
Which is nice.
Yeah. What I think is interesting about the orders that he gives regarding how they are to march out of where they are encamped is that I can't recall in this moment whether God has said you're going to be in the wilderness for the next 40 years up to this point.
Hang on, say that again.
Has God, up to this point, already told them that they're going to be in the wilderness for 40 years? Did we discover that or remember that?
No, I don't think he did, because he assumed that they would take the promised land the first time.
Right, okay. So then that means when he's giving this instruction to pick up their camp and march out, it is a short-term...
Definitely. It's for direct war thing. That's coming up soon.
Right, yeah. So, I guess when we think about it being an 11-day journey from Egypt to Israel by foot, or 2-week journey, or whatever you want to say, however slow you are, God's intention was that they would take more time than that because they were actually going to take possession of a land. It was a it was actually a crusade. It was something that they had a mission, and the mission was very important for them to follow at exactly. So he spent a whole year walking them through things in Mount Sinai, giving them instructions and all that stuff, so that by the time they finally got to the promised land, they could take possession of it, even if it meant that they'd only been on the road for a year and a half instead of 40 years. So it's just interesting that this instruction that God gives the people of Israel is supposed to just be short term, but it ends up being quite a long term order.
Yep.
Interesting.
Which is funny that it works either way.
Yeah. Well, maybe he had that in mind.
Yep.
Maybe he's smart. I don't know. Could be.
Maybe he's smart.
All right. So at this point, I suppose they're still eating manna and quail and drinking water from whatever rocks and things they find water at, and palm trees and all these different things that we've
rock water
read about in Exodus and Leviticus. So I guess that means the jobs that they are given here to be fighting men or to be priests, that's pretty much the only two options they have. They can't be biscuit chefs. They can't be soil tenders. They can't do any of the fun stuff.
Man, I want to be a biscuit chef still.
I still want to be a soil tender. And so I'm keeping that on the horizon for me maybe in the future.
Yeah.
Why be a farmer when you can be a soil tender? So, yeah. We have reached the end of this episode. Jeremy, do you have any closing thoughts or perhaps advice taken from the Book of Numbers?
Yeah, the Book of Numbers in Chapter 6 seems to point at people with beards are more holy.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Shout out to all the bearded men in the room. You're pretty holy.
Could you elaborate on that?
The Nazarite vow is like this thing
Yes.
God called specific people into, and we'll probably cover this again in another episode,
yeah,
but
probably.
They weren't supposed to drink, they weren't supposed to cut their hair, they weren't supposed to be around dead people, and a few other things, but it's just, it seems like there's a revolution of Nazarite vows right now with straight-edge hipsters all over the place.
Right, yeah.
And most of them are vegans, which I think is a part of it too, so shout out to all the Nazarite vowers.
Yeah, nice. Way to go, guys.
And the biscuit chefs.
Well, that's it, I suppose. My name's Ryan.
And my name is Bass McBassman.
And
otherwise known as Jeremy.
We will see you in the next episode. Or you'll hear us, either one. See ya.